Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Joe Epstein, a past president of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors and your moderator for today's program. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. Tonight's program is part of the Commonwealth Club's Russia series, sponsored by Pitch and Kathy Johnson. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Dr. Lilia Shevstova, a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and an author of the new book, Russia, Lost in Transition, the Yeltsin and the Putin Legacies. Just a few months ago, Dr. Gloria Duffy, the Commonwealth Club's president and CEO, met with our honored guest, Dr. Lilia Shevstova, while on a Commonwealth Club trip to Russia. An invitation to address the club followed, and we are very privileged tonight to welcome her. Dr. Shevstova co-chairs the Russian Domestic Politics and Political Institutions Project at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and she divides her time between the Carnegie offices in Washington, D.C., and Moscow. Before joining the Carnegie Endowment, she was the deputy director of the Moscow Institute of International Economics and Political Studies of the Russian Academy of Sciences, and a director of the Center of Political Studies in Moscow. She received her PhD in political science from the Institute of International Relations and the Russian Academy of Sciences, and is a professor at the Moscow State Institute of International Relations of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Russia. She has been a visiting professor at the University of California at Berkeley and Cornell University, as well as a fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Dr. Shevstova is also a leading researcher at Chatham House, Royal Institute for International Affairs in London. She is a member of the Women in International Security Advising Board and a member of the Executive Board of the International Institute for Strategic Studies in Great Britain. She's an associate with the Eurasia Program of the Social Science Research Council. And Dr. Shevstova is a member of the board of the Institute for Human Sciences at Boston University. Dr. Shevstova's forthcoming book, Russia, Lost in Transition, the Yeltsin and Putin Legacies, has just been published. Other recent books by Dr. Shevstova include Putin's Russia and Russia's Engagement with the West, Transformation and Integration in the 21st Century. Please, let's take this opportunity to give a warm Commonwealth Club welcome to distinguished scholar, Dr. Lilia Shevstova.
Thank you, Mr. President, for your very kind introduction. This is great pleasure for me. This is honor. And this is fun to be here, especially at this very important moment of Russian current history. And let me start my brief comments with a quote that, of course, all members of the Commonwealth Club know. We only propose to find the truth and set it loose in the world. I like this quote very much. And it reminds me about another quote from George Orwell, 30 years later. Honest people should tell only truth and fight with misperceptions and fallacies. Well, those words are really very relevant, not only in our times, but in respect of the topic that I'm going to discuss, Russia, current Russia, Putin's and post-Putin's Russia. Because sometimes simple and primitive understanding of the country that we Russia hands, we Russia watches pretty often are developing. Sometimes fallacies, misperceptions, inadequate understanding of the country and of our relationship with the United States of America bring misunderstanding in politics, and not very prudent policy. So that's why it seems to me It's very important for us analysts from Russia, representatives of Russian community, Russian liberals, first of all, to come and meet with you, to have this dialogue in order to bring mutual understanding of very serious challenges and problems that lie ahead of us. So Russia, even 1 year ago, was taken for granted. Russia was considered a past tense problem. Russia was considered a junior partner of the West, of the United States, or country in permanent decline, or at best, future potential successful emerging markets. And suddenly, out of the blue, unexpectedly, for majority political leaders, at least in the Western Hemisphere, unexpectedly for many of us, Russia became an unpleasant surprise. After 15 years of retreat, decline, of stagnation, of collapse, Russia is back. As a spoiler, not always as a benevolent country. And so what do we have now? We have now Russia playing macho posturing game with European Union and threatening to retarget its missiles at the NATO countries. We see Moscow and the Kremlin doing hardball game with Washington and President Putin forces both secretaries, Secretary Rice and Secretary Gates, to wait for more than 40 minutes before giving them a condescending conversation and teaching them how to behave and understand politics. We have Russia bullying Georgia, Estonia, Ukraine, and other countries. We have Russian political leaders threatening to abrogate very important blocks of the military security, INF, and we already started the way to abrogate CFE, Conventional Forces in Europe Treaty. So this is very important security architecture in Europe. And even more, we see how Russian military and political leaders are thinking and making plans, not only to sell further. We are selling weapons to Venezuela and Syria, but we are going further. We are going to build new aircraft and missiles carriers. Thinking about the American Sixth Fleet in Mediterranean, close to Suez. Of course, President Putin in Iraq, well, that's a very strange mistake. In Iran, wanted to be a moderator, and more, wanted to be there in order to be the arbitrator of the situation, only recently and today. And finally, Russia has invented a new policy doctrine, which would put the country as one of the arbitrators between these civilizations. And Russia sees a lot of other problems in a different way. And there are some sensitive issues and challenges for the United States of America, not only Iraq and Iran, but still unfinished business in Afghanistan, still Kosovo and Balkans, still energy security and pipelines through the Caspian, still the stability in the bigger regions, in the regions of big Central Asia and ascending China, and a lot of other issues, just several of them, infectious diseases, migration, demography. Well, I can go ahead, you know, with this long list of problems. And, of course, for the Western United States, it's better to have Russia on the Western side than Russia as a spoiler. So all these new things, Russia is back, of course, forces us to think, what's happening with this country? Why out of the blue Russia is back and being not a friend of the West? So what's its trajectory? Where is Russia heading? And I have several points to discuss or to offer you. Firstly, about the country, which continues to be a mix, which continues to be a mess and kasha, which continues to have incompatible trends and vectors simultaneously. Sometimes I compare the situation to the skier with his skis pointing in opposite direction. Can you imagine? On the one hand, Russia is the market country. On the other hand, we have the constant expansion of the state in the economic area. On the one hand, Russia has still elected monarchy, czarist power, personified power. But this power cannot be legitimized by anything else, only elections. Russia, on the one hand, is federation. But on the other hand, this is, in practice, a unitarian state. And so on and so on. So how we should view this kind of paradox, this kind of hybrid? Well, to tell you the truth, it's rather difficult. Let me just give some few brushstrokes to paint this broad Russia canvas and just to show what is important, at least in my view. First of all, of course, Russia's success story. Russia is a success, and success unexpected for us liberals and Democrats. I'm talking about economy, first of all. Russia currently has absolutely wonderful economic financial stabilization, and all Western countries could be jealous of it. Russia's annual economic growth is 7.8%, better than some other countries have. Russia's stock market is 83% up last year. And I don't want to bother you with all these numbers about GDP, etc., but according to Goldman Sachs, Russia apparently will be, according to their estimates, Russia should be 6 trillion economy and number 5 in the world economy by year 2025. So Russia is pretty successful, and not only in the extractive sectors. We have pretty successful some other sectors of economy. And beyond, Russian rich people are becoming richer much faster than Americans. We have 100,000 millionaires who are officially open millionaires and 55 billionaires on the Forbes list. And the number of Russian rich people is growing much faster, 20% faster than the number of rich people in the United States of America. So it's a pretty successful country, and a lot of people are viewing it as El Dorado. Russians, ordinary Russians, have started to live better. And the number of people living below poverty line has decreased from 25% or no, even 35, at least 10 years ago, to 18% currently. And Russia is a stable country. You can't even compare Putin's Russia to Yeltsin's Russia. And this 85% of approval rating that President Vladimir Putin has, I don't know a single Western leader who can aspire to this approval rating. But this is only one part of the picture, because in reality this is a Jekyll and Hyde picture. On the other hand, we have something else. That's why it's very important to see the shades of meaning and the picture in complexity, not as a black and white, but everything altogether. The picture would be gray. So on the other hand, we have the country which success is based, of course, on oil price, but not only on oil price. We've been very lucky. Russia has been unlucky with its history, but very lucky with the oil price. So, but not only oil there is the reason for success. Also, consumption, and again consumption, and external borrowing. We borrow a lot of money from the West, and the West is giving us money. I don't know why. And of course, when we look at the structure of the economy, this is the typical petrostate. We can compare Russia to Venezuela, to Algeria, to Indonesia 10 years ago, because all elements of petrostate are in place. Marriage between power and property, the rent-seeking economy, rentier class, of course, elements of Dutch disease, corruption, and the gaps, disparities between rich and poor, everything is in Russia. Just small. Venezuela is the example of big Russia. But at the same time, this is not a petrostate. Because petrostate with global nuclear ambitions, this is a phenomena in the world. This is the unique element. We never had nuclear petrostate in the world history, and we do not know how the monster, the phenomena, this very interesting mixture will behave. Nuclear petrostate with global ambitions and with the possibility to use the commodities, oil and gas, soft power, as hard power. And already bullying not only the new independent states, Ukraine and plus, but also Europe, Germany, France, and the rest of Europe bullying with our soft hard power. So this is something else. And as for social picture, this is drama, this is bizarre. When we are losing population, 149 Russians in 1991, and now 142 million Russians. And only one out of three Russians feel himself that he is healthy. And 70% of Russian kids have chronic disease. So this is the danger of reproduction of the future population, of future generation of Russians for a long time. And if we fail, if Russia fails to abrogate these trends, then in 70 years' time, it will be a problem for Russia to keep control of the Far East and Siberia. And it will be the problem for the West and the United States, because then we'll have the vacuum with ascending China close by, with billions of people, at least hundreds of millions, waiting for the territory. And as for political stability, it's also a puzzle and a myth. Because to have stability based on approval rating of President Putin, on oil price, and on hope, it's a rather brittle stability. And we all know what hope means. It's always a delayed disappointment. So this is the Russian mix. But what about foreign policy? Yes, of course, it's very important to see, firstly, what is the domestic situation, but what is the correlation between domestic situation, domestic developments, and foreign policy? And I already mentioned about new Russian assertiveness. Russia is back. So what are the reasons of this assertiveness? And what are the reasons of anti-Western assertiveness of current Putin's Russia? I would say there are, of course, external factors that explain a lot. First of all, conviction of the Russian political elite that what we observe now is the decline of preponderance of the only superpower that we have, the United States of America. And Russian political class believes that this decline is not a temporary phenomenon. One more factor, crisis of the European community, crisis of expansion. But in fact, this kind of conglomerate has lost its dynamic and trajectory. So this, of course, also pushes Russian political elite to be more aggressive and to fill the niche. And of course, political stability and oil prices and possibility to influence other countries. And we don't forget that Russia is number one gas producer in the world, number two oil producer in the world. It gives a lot of self-confidence to the Russian political elite. But these factors are not the most important, are not crucial in explaining the Russia-backed revisionism and revanchist ambitions of this country, of my country. There is another factor, and this factor I would define as necessity. And necessity means the following. When you don't have the uniting idea, and Marxism already not the ideology for this country, and you don't have other ideas, and when you have constantly centralized, hyper-centralized state, you need somehow to justify the centralization in current times. You have somehow to legitimize it. You have to explain to the people why do you need such a pyramidal structure of power, and why do you need to concentrate all levers of power in the hands of one man in the modern age, in the 21st century. This is not the 19th century anymore. So you have to explain people. You have to explain Russians why they need to live in a closed society without real opposition and free press. And the most effective justification is the enemy, besieged mentality. And Russia, in order to defend herself or itself, has to look for the enemy. So this aggressiveness on the foreign policy field and suspicion towards the West and outside world is the only and the most effective justification of the authoritarian power inside of the country. And foreign policy became in Russia the servant of domestic agenda. And especially now, when Russia is on the eve of self-perpetuation of power, on the eve of the transfer of power, when Putin is finishing his tenure, his presidential tenure, the political cycle. At this period, even more, the political class in Russia and the Kremlin folks, the Kremlin team, needs to have an enemy in order to keep the society under control. So this is the most important explanation, although defined by me in a very crude form, explanation of Russian assertiveness. But you'll ask me a question. This means, then, that Russian political class is ready or able or wanting or eager for a confrontation, for a serious friction with the West? No, I would reply. No, not at all. Russian political class would like to have it both ways, to be with the West, to be inside of the West, and to be against the West. So, and Putin's doctrine, and the doctrine of Russian Foreign Affairs Minister Lavrov, of course you know some of our names, is the following. The West should be partner and opponent at the same time. And so far, President Putin has been pretty successful with implementing of this doctrine. Successful in what sense? Successful in baffling, puzzling, perplexing the West, because really Western capitals simply do not know what to do with this kind of zigzagging and vacillations. To be friends and enemies at the same time, it's a pretty complicated foreign policy agenda. But where Russian political class really failed, they failed to guarantee the future for this type of relationship, because in the end, what we have in reality, the outcome of this opponent and friend, or friend and opponent policy, the outcome is suspicion, mutual suspicion, frosty relations with Europe, with the United States, with new independent states, and hardly a possibility of making it better, at least during this political cycle, at least until President Putin is in power. So that's what we have in the end. Several paradoxes. I see I am looking at the watch. My time is running fast. Several just very brief points. Russian paradoxes. Well, all countries have paradoxes in their development. But I will just mention several Russian paradoxes that make situation quite complicated to understand, but quite intriguing and interesting for intellectual digestion. In Russia, success is not always a success. Success could be a positive element for a time being, but not for the future. Success could be in Russia detrimental. And only the explanation of this paradox. For the time being, we have economic success based on oil price. But because of this success, all Russian reforms have been stalled, because nobody ever did reforms having $75 per barrel. So economic success currently is Russia's liability, stopping Russia from pushing ahead market and other reforms. So success is our impediment. Another paradox, stability. Stability is based, first of all, as I've mentioned, on oil price and approval rating. But what would happen if the oil price plunges? If an oil and approval rating cannot be transferred from one personality to another? So factors of stability could become easily factors of instability. Third paradox, Russian political class love certainty. The whole structure of power should guarantee certainty for the political elite. And in the end, trying to achieve this highest degree of certainty by liquidating, abrogating, annihilating political opposition and any kind of independence of media and free society. In fact, we found ourselves in the situation of complete uncertainty, because we don't know what would happen tomorrow. Our strategy and horizon stops in March 2007, when President Putin has to leave the office, and we don't know what's going to happen after that. And my hunch and even conviction is President Putin himself does not know what is going to happen to him. So it's the complete reproduction, constant reproduction of uncertainty. And one brief point about two laws that rule this country. Well, when I've been thinking about these laws, I came to a conclusion that Russia is not unique in this aspect. I am thinking about law of unintended consequences. Well, just one example. Russia wanted to guarantee for its Gazprom, for its gas empire, total control of Europe, but did it in a such bullish way that only we forced Europe to do unbelievable thing for Europeans. Europeans now are working on the common energy strategy. And it would have never happened without Russian bullying. So this is how the law of unintended consequences is working. Well, I know some other countries that also follow the law of unintended consequences. Another Russian law, the law of failure. One example, Gorbachev wanted to reform the Soviet Union. And it did in such a way that nobody now wants or believes in any possibility of building the Soviet Union again. And apparently we have to drink this bitter cup of tea until the end and fail with our top-down governance and with our attempts to modernize the country from the top. And after finding that we are in a dead end and hitting our head, hitting the wall with our head, we'll start to look for another option and scenario. Maybe we are doomed to develop through the law of failure. And of course, a lot depends when and whether Russian political elite and Russian political society understand the truth about this kind of system that we have, which is successful now, but not sustainable in the future. So a lot depends whether this political elite understands that this system is not sustainable, that hyper-presidency and centralized state cannot function normally and effectively and successfully in the 21st century if they understand it before it starts unravel. If not, if they fail to understand it, then we'll follow the axiom defined by one of the greatest men of the 20th century, historian Arnold Toynbee, who wrote about the suicidal statecraft when some countries undermine themselves. I understand that my time is nearly, well, I have to close. And let me close with reminding us about Churchill. And of course, I don't have in mind Churchill's Russia's axiom when he compared Russia to riddle, puzzle, etc. I would remind you about Churchill who alluded to Americans. He said, "I like Americans because in the end, they choose the best solution and option. But after they've exhausted all other options." And, you know, I compare Americans and Russians. I see that we are following the second part of Churchill's axiom. We are trying to exhaust all possible options. But I don't know whether we'll come to the first part of this of Churchill's idiom and when. And let me finish on an optimistic note, on a typically Russian optimistic note. A very popular political joke in Russia, and you'll see the flavor of our optimism. A sick man is picked up by the ambulance, and he asks the doctor, "Doctor," he says, "where are you taking me?" "To the morgue," says the doctor. "But I'm not dead yet." "We are not there yet." Thank you.
Our thanks to Dr. Lilia Shevstova, Senior Associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and author of Russia, Lost in Transition, The Yeltsin and Putin Legacies. Thank you, Dr. Shevstova, for your comments this evening. As you can see, we have a large number of questions for you this evening. They are all over the board, but believe me, each one pertains to what you have been saying in your prepared remarks. They're all about Russia, and let me start with this one. You mentioned when you began, and you quoted the Commonwealth Club saying, one of the slogans of the Commonwealth Club, and that is, and I quote, "We only propose to find the truth and set it loose in the world." And the question is, if that's such a wonderful quote, please comment on the lack of freedom that the press enjoys in Russia, and also from the lack of freedom that the press has in former Soviet countries.
Well, I must tell you that I can comment from the position of the Russian liberal. Lack of freedom, crackdown of the current political administration, Russian government, on freedom means only one thing. They cannot rule in the free, pluralistic society. And apparently current Russian political team believes that they cannot control Russia, and they are control freaks. They cannot control Russia if Russia has independent sources of information, if Russia has independent court system, if Russia has independent parliament. So apparently this is the conviction of the people still believing in the personalized power and Soviet myths, who apparently believe, sincerely believe, that by cracking down on everything that moves freely and independently, they could in the end modernize the country. But as a result, by cracking down on rule of law, independent media, etc., they only have created a fertile ground for corruption, for gray zone, for informal rules of the informal rules of the game. And in fact, this is the major reason why in Russia we have all stalled reforms. The problem is when they will recognize that they made a mistake, maybe never.
So this quote from the Commonwealth Club has engendered another question from the audience. Are there counterparts to the Commonwealth Club in Moscow? I know we had a brief discussion about the club before the program started. If no, are you free to give the same talk that you did this evening to, or if there is a counterpart, could you give the same talk to the Russian counterpart of the Commonwealth Club?
Oh, well, we've been discussing possibility that Moscow Carnegie Center could host all groups and delegations of the Commonwealth, and we did it already twice, and we'll be very glad to host you again. So we at least could be candidate for your counterpart and for dialogue with you in Moscow. And regarding whether I have possibility to do the same talks in Moscow, yes, I do them. And we still have audiences for such people like myself. I'm forbidden from radio and TV, which is kind of, well, I really suffer without broader audience. But I have possibility to use websites pretty often. And still, as I've said, this society is not black and white society. This society is hybrid society. So we have possibility for discussing these things openly in more or less smaller audiences. So this is not the police state. And just to finish it, and this is bad that Russia is not a dictatorship. Because sometimes when you have at least limited possibility to speak, when you have some independent media but print in print, you can get an impression that this country is more or less free. And in this situation, you know, the movement towards democracy, it could be more slow.
It seems as if Boris Yeltsin regularly shot from the hip as president, as opposed to setting specific goals, establishing a plan, and attempting to stay on course. Would you agree with this statement?
Well, yes. Yeltsin was the most chaotic political leader that could be imagined. But at the same time, Yeltsin had no ambition or agenda to control everything because he had problems in controlling himself. So it left quite a lot of possibility for free movements, free society, for free media. But at the same time, I regrettably, it was Yeltsin who shot the parliament in 1993. It was Yeltsin who adopted the authoritarian constitution in 1993. And it was Yeltsin who became the godfather, or even the biological father of the current super-centralized regime. Putin is his political son.
This is a follow-up question. Which Russian leader, Gorbachev, Boris Yeltsin, or Vladimir Putin, achieved more completely the goals which each set out for themselves and for the country?
Well, it's difficult to be a shrink because sometimes I wonder what really these political leaders, what kind of goals they were trying to achieve. But if we judge, make conclusions on the basis of the results of the activity, then we'll come to a conclusion that Gorbachev apparently failed because he never wanted the Soviet Union to collapse. So he can reflect the real, you know, implementation of the law of unintended consequences. As for Yeltsin, I would say at the beginning, Yeltsin would never believe apparently that he would end like he ended in 1996, being weak, inadequate, and going through falsified elections, and in 1999 being forced to transfer the power to another guy. So apparently his dreams also didn't come true. As for Putin, it's too early to judge because we need to have post-Putin's epoch and era in order to understand what Putin's legacy is. And so far, we don't know whether he even can control his legacy, or maybe he will end also in a desperate and dramatic way, just like his two predecessors, being hostage and victim of his own developments, of his own legacy.
Several questions about Russia and a market economy, or lack thereof. From Gorbachev to Putin, have any leaders ever truly understood how a market economy works versus a planned economy? And hasn't Russia's oil wealth covered up possibly some failures at developing a market economy in that country?
Here I have to be more optimistic than I've been previously. It seems to me Gorbachev left political scene without understanding what market really is. Yeltsin started to learn, and he learned enough in order to give freedom to the economy. Well, this freedom wasn't used in a proper way and wasn't used very successfully, but at least he was courageous enough to give all reins of power to the liberal technocrats. Well, another thing, whether they were successful or not. Putin has been learning to be a market, pro-market political leader for the last 15 years. And it seems to be he's been quite successful in understanding the axioms of the market. His problem and peculiarity is he believes that the market could be successful only if the state controls the market. So in the result we have, he failed to diversify the economy. And he has created mega corporations like Gazprom that are the most murky companies and that he himself apparently has problems to understand what's going inside of these companies.
It seems as if this questioner asks, if after Gorbachev broke with the past tyranny of the USSR, Vladimir Putin may be leading the country back to that period of Russian history. Could you comment on that, please?
Totally agree. President Putin, intentionally or unintentionally, in fact has thrown Russia back to the pre-Gorbachev period. But here's a very interesting caveat. As a matter of fact, you can't jump into the same river twice. And that's why, you know, hardly he could return to the party state into the communism. And he himself has proved that he definitely is anti-communist person. So he has returned to the personalized power, but without the communist rhetoric and Soviet type of gimmicks.
Let's stay with some economic questions here. What specifically, Dr. Shevstova, are the other economic segments besides oil and gas that are going on in Russia? Do you know what Putin's plan is to diversify the economy? If there is no reasonable plan, how will this impact the West?
Well, frankly speaking, I hear about such plans of diversification of Russian economy once a year in every annual message of President Putin to the nation. So far, I don't see any results. So you may have an agenda and you may have a plan, but the problem is that you end the year with a plan without results. Well, what are other branches of industry that are important in Russia besides commodity? Commodity, of course, is the queen of the Russian economy, but ironically, we have some other sectors that are developing pretty fast, like construction, food industry. And you'll ask why these industries, these branches are developing rather fast. Because there is no strong state interest, and because the gangs that are ruling Russia are not interested so far in construction, in timber, in food. The moment they start to get interest, apparently, well, we'll have problems with these branches of economic as well. Maybe I forgot to reply to.
That was an excellent answer, I believe. So here's a question about the economy with a political overtone. As the price of oil increases, now it's close to $100 a barrel, mm-hmm. $12 or $13 away from it. How much does this embolden President Putin and Russia on the global scene? And if oil does reach $100 a barrel, do you think Russia will flex its muscles even more globally?
Well, I don't have even need to respond to that because I would agree. We have this kind of axiom. The higher the oil price is, the more sure Russian political elite is feeling itself. Simply, these folks, it seems to me, have no imagination because they don't understand the truth about the oil case. And they forgot Russian history. In 1996, in 1986, sixfold decline, plunge in oil price, in fact, had triggered the collapse of the Soviet Union. In 1998, twofold collapse of the oil price, in fact, nearly annihilated a Russian economy. So even if we, let's say, have the price about $25 per barrel, I don't think that our stabilization fund will be enough for 2 years to keep the country afloat.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program with Dr. Lilia Shevstova, Senior Associate at the Carnegie Foundation for International Peace, who is discussing Russian politics and the legacy of Vladimir Putin. The legacy of Vladimir Putin, let's talk about the future of Vladimir Putin. You touched on this in your prepared remarks. It is nearly 8 years since Putin took office. Do you think that he will ever have any real opposition again as Russia's chief executive? Does an overwhelming victory for Putin's party, United Russia, mean the end of any opposition again to Putin?
Well, so far I don't see any signs that before parliamentary elections in December this year and before presidential elections in March next year, we can have a hope to have a really viable and strong political opposition. Everything has been done in order to annihilate such a possibility. So it will be the choice or elections without much choice. But frankly speaking, lack of political opposition on the political scene, does not mean that there is no opposition within the society and even among the political class. And lack of institutional opposition is compensated by constant bickering and squabbling between the clans and between different gangs. And quite recently, a Russian new phenomena has been bickering between the special services that are fighting each other in order to control either the Kremlin or President Putin's heir or the asset redistribution. So lack of official opposition does not mean that we don't have a very desperate, bloody fight in politics and over property.
Dr. Shevstova, are we heading towards a new Cold War between a Putin-led Russia and the United States?
I hope that I will never have this dream come true. I will never have this kind of catastrophic scenario realized. I don't believe in that. I don't believe that Russia and the United States are even in the situation of the Cold War, because in order to have the real serious confrontation, both countries have to have at least more or less equal resources, and we do not have that. Ideology, goals to fight, we don't have that. Fortunately, I don't believe that we'll ever return to the times of the Cold War, but unfortunately, frictions and disagreements and serious disagreements are possible, and we have them over many issues so far.
Well, we certainly don't want to return to that era, and I think it's appropriate at this time to ask a question by a visitor tonight who just returned from Russia and said that his or her impression was of a generally low standard of living, basically a downtrodden people who acted like sheep, and generally a ruling class currently not much different from that of the czars or the aristocracy of the communists.
Well, I would say that the living standards are much higher now than they were in the 90s. In the 90s, people simply didn't get the salaries and pensions. Now, people are getting salaries and pensions, and medium and just average salary is approximately $350, $400 a month. So in comparing with the 90s, it's a pretty stable level for many people. But of course, there are huge disparities. And the difference between the 10% of the overage people and 10% of the poor people is approximately the ratio 25 to 1. If you have the ratio 1 to 17, that would mean that country has very brittle and fragile stability.
I'd like to give my own observation. About 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, my wife and I were in St. Petersburg, and there was a comment by our host that really stuck with me, and that was that under the former Soviet Union, there was no reason to really get up. Every day was exactly like the previous day. But currently, under the Putin leadership, that there are opportunities and more optimism. Do you agree with that?
Depends what kind of population we are looking at. Most optimistic, of course, are young people. Among the young people between 18 and 24 years old, according to the service, only 10% of these younger people do not have money to buy food. Approximately about 25% of those people do not have money in order to, for instance, to buy much more important things like clothes, etc. When we take, for instance, people over 50, we'll find that approximately 30% among these people do not have enough money, enough means to buy food. That means that the younger generation should be much more optimistic, and they are optimistic. They are very supportive of Putin because Putin gave them a kind of hope for the future, and especially with the slogan, Russia is back, they feel much more cocky and much more optimistic than ever before. But of course, the situation is very complicated, and we do not know what will happen even to those optimistic young people in case of crisis, turmoil, or collapse of the system, or in case the oil prices start to plunge.
You had mentioned a quote by Winston Churchill about Americans, something like Americans will make the right decision after they've tried two or three
yes,
other ones. So maybe this question is appropriate within that framework. Did the United States miss a big opportunity by not being more forthcoming to help Russia in the 1990s and support its admission to NATO?
Well, it's a very difficult question, and my belief is that every transformation and all problems or all successes have to be achievement of the nation. We have to sort it out ourselves. I'm talking about Russians. But at the same time, I would say Russian oligarchic capitalism, Russian money laundering, Russian billionaires who have accounts in all Western banks, and in fact siphoning and channeling of billions and billions of dollars annually from Russia abroad, would have never been possible without the assistance of the Western business, Western banks, and without the acquiescence of the Western countries. And if you read, for instance, freshly edited and freshly published and translated memoirs of Gerhard Schröder, the former German chancellor, where he, in fact, praises Vladimir Putin as the democrat and liberal, as the guy who cannot do more for Russia than he did, you'll find that a lot of political leaders in the West, not only Schröder, but Berlusconi, Italian, Chirac, French, former French president, have been co-opted to become friends of Russian political regime, who endorse regime, legitimize it, etc. It seems to me that the West, including the United States, have lost the opportunity not to help Russia inside of Russia to make successful reforms, but to create much more benevolent environment for Russian transformation, doing some not very prudent steps like, for instance, NATO expansion at the moment when it only accelerated the suspicion on the part of the Russian population towards the West. But it struck me that I should give you absolutely fascinating number. Still, you know, in the 90s, 68% of Russians view the United States as the most friendly country. Today, only 43% of Russians view the United States as a friendly country. But simply, this says that Russians are not anti-American oriented. Russians are looking towards America. Russians are suspicious of political leaders, and even of Russian political elite, of American political elite. But so far, Russians are much more pro-American than, for instance, French society, Italian, or Spanish society, which is, ironical, of course.
Well, it's very interesting to know about relationships between Russia and the United States and the rest of the world. But let's talk about the relationship between Russia and the former Soviet states. What are those relationships like? Are there any real hot spots of contention that could erupt into a conflict?
Putin, we have to give him due. Putin tried, at least at the beginning, to normalize the relationship between Russia and new independent states, with the exception of Georgia. For some time, he was pretty successful. But recently, trying to use especially commodity, oil and gas price, as the instrument of leverage and impact, currently Kremlin started to have tensions, not only with Georgia, but with Baltic republics. And the relationship between Russia and Ukraine, Russia and Belarus, are not pretty normal and not friendly as before. That means that Russia still is in the process of finding a more constructive and positive formula of its relations with former satellites, with former Soviet republics, and with new independent states. This period hasn't come. And having this centralized power inside of Russia, hardly we could expect that we'll have flexible, friendly, and equal relations with new independent states.
Several questions here about Chechnya. Did Gorbachev and Yeltsin have to deal with a high level of terrorism from Chechnya like Putin did? And how would you rate Putin's handling of the Chechnyans' rebellion?
After the second Chechen war, we have diminished risk and threat of the terrorism on the part of the Chechen separatists. But this doesn't mean that there is no threat at all. And we have nearly weekly or at least monthly cases of terrorist attacks on the Northern Caucasus. Well, as a matter of fact, the Kremlin has been pretty successful in installing in the Northern Caucasian republics, including Chechnya, installing sultanistic regimes that, in fact, keep situation so far under control. But the future outcome of this situation could be the new generation of the youngsters, which with which will be much more radical in the sense, will join the Islamist forces, which will be much more suspicious of Moscow and Russia, which will be much more suspicious of their current regime. So, unfortunately, I regret to say, the situation with terrorism is not over, because those republics and those regimes in the Northern Caucasus are not sustainable. And what would happen after the deal between Putin and those regimes is over is an open question. The jury is out on that issue.
Would you say that Putin's efforts to place more power in the central government, that could be a cause of discontent in Chechnya? And could you list even a few other causes in addition to what you just stated about discontent in that state?
I would say no. I would disagree with this proposition. I would say that continued discontent among major part—we don't know which part, frankly speaking—but among part of the Chechen population is the result, firstly, of pathetic living conditions, lack of job for younger generation. Lack of funds for education, health system, etc., etc. So simply the life in Chechnya and in all other Northern Caucasian republics is not normal. How to make it normal? That's a problem. And the problem is not only democracy. The problem is economic reform and new economic infrastructure, which current political government cannot create. That's why we are keeping situation under tough lid. But when we open the lid, nobody knows what is in the kettle.
Dr. Shevstova, could you discuss the ethnic minority challenges currently for the new Russia?
Well, Russia, in fact, is much more homogeneous state than ever before, but we have Muslim minorities. And in 25 years, because of the demographic situation, there will be much more Muslims in Russia than before, especially in the Tatarstan, Bashkortostan, and other Muslim regions. So this is the problem for Russia, how to coordinate the interests of different cultures, how to build not homogeneous national state, but how to build a real federation, multi-ethnic state. So far, it seems to me, we are not learning the lessons of the past, and so far, we didn't find the real format, the real formula for the multi-ethnic identity of the Russian population. This is the problem that will haunt us pretty soon, especially after the leaders of the post-Soviet leaders of Tatarstan, Bashkortostan, and other republics are gone from the political scene. Then again, there could be a kind of new political revival of national, with national flavor or nationalistic flavor.
Well, Russia seems to be in the news every day. They're certainly in the news today. The visit of Vladimir Putin to see Ahmadinejad in Iran has really captured the airwaves. So in your opinion, why is President Putin in Iran? Is it to support a nuclear Iran, as he indicated today, to enhance trade, to maybe sell sophisticated military hardware like air defense systems to protect against an air attack by the United States or Israel? Negotiate military alliances, many topics.
Well,
to choose from.
My belief, well, I don't, of course, I'm not discussing these issues with the President Putin, so I don't know his direct and indirect agenda, but my hunch, my assumption is that President Putin, he's the first Russian leader that after the war is visiting Iran. So this is important state visit, you know, from the Russian point of view. And President Putin is in Iran, firstly, because he wants Russia and himself. He wants to play a role in solution of the Iranian conundrum, point number one. And it seems to me Russia, having Iran as a close neighbor, well, has fully justified ambition to play a role. Secondly, it seems to me President Putin believes that he could be arbitrator in the conflict between Ahmadinejad and Iranian leadership and the West, first of all, the United States of America. Thirdly, Russia has economic and commercial interests. in Iran, which are important. But much more important, apparently, is the message that President Putin wants to give. And the message that he is given is not that black and white. In fact, he firstly said that but also the members of other Caspian countries, Caspian Club, that had a meeting in Tehran, five countries, Caspian countries, together with Russia, Iran, Azerbaijan, Turkmenistan, and Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan, they agreed that apparently these countries should not host third powers on their territories that can use their power against any member of the Caspian Club. So this was a message to the United States of America. But there was another message, not only warning to the United States, there was a warning to Iranian leadership and Ahmadinejad, because Ahmadinejad looked and viewed the Putin's visit as the readiness of Russia to pledge to finish the nuclear plant in Bushehr. What Putin said was very interesting. Putin said, yes, we make pledges and we follow our commitments, but I cannot give you any promises. When I was a small boy, I gave promises to my mom, and I'm not going to give promises to you. What that meant? This meant that he's not going to, he's not going to follow Iranian agenda, and he gives Iranian leadership a warning. I'm not going to support you totally because I don't want to anger the United States and the West. So, in fact, in Iran, in Tehran, Putin was behaving according to his formula to be the friend and partner of the United States and to be opponent of the United States. He doesn't want to go and to have serious frictions with Washington.
Along the same line of questioning is a question about the missile defense system that the U.S. proposes. President Putin's public statements regarding the United States' proposed missile defense system in Central Europe are very critical of the U.S. and of NATO. Do you think that privately he may be more supportive of this defense system? Might Russia ever really join forces with the U.S. and NATO in building such a defense system?
Well, in fact, in 2002, President Putin proposed to President Bush, when Bush was in Moscow, Putin proposed to create, to build a joint anti-missile ballistic system, NATO plus Russia. At that moment, Americans were not interested. And at that moment, President Bush abrogated ABM Treaty, one of the blocks of the nuclear non-proliferation security. And at the moment, Putin absolutely candidly, and it seems to me he is sincere, in total rejection of the American missile shield in Czech Republic and Poland. And it seems to me both Putin and the Russian military, they do believe that this shield is directed not only against Iran, but first of all against future Russian launches on the Russian territory. So there is deep suspicion towards American initiative. But at the same time, there are possibilities to bridge the gap. And President Putin already gave Americans several suggestions, suggesting two radar stations on the Russian territory to be included into the future structure of the anti-missile defense shield. Americans would like to accept Russian radars, but to keep radar in Czech Republic. So far, this is the major point of disagreement and friction, the radar station on the territory of the Czech Republic. I would say the most prudent solution would be to freeze situation at the moment, especially during, well, when Putin and Bush are closing, you know, their political cycles, to freeze and to let other political leaders to come and to think again about the joint anti-missile defense initiative. And I would believe that there would be at least some possibilities to bridge this gap at least next year. But this is the most important and serious irritant in the U.S.-Russian relations, which, by the way, makes it difficult to give do progress in some other field, for instance, in the field of civilian nuclear cooperation in some other areas of joint effort, especially in the Nunn-Lugar program.
A quick question on China. It's very difficult to have a discussion like this and talk about global issues without even mentioning China. What is Russia's relationship with China now, and how will their relationship change as Russia develops economically?
Russia and China are very good economic partners, and the trade volume between Russia and China grows constantly. Russia and China are together members of the Shanghai Group Corporation, where, by the way, this is the organization where China is the leader. And at the same time, frankly speaking, my view of the Russian-Chinese cooperation is the following. Russia and China are dating each other without much love, with a lot of suspicion, especially on the part of Russia, because, well, any country will be suspicious of this ascendant giant on its borders. And at the same time, both countries are trying to use each other and each other's dating in order, you know, to get some kind of leverage on the United States and the West. So they're dating with their eyes looking at the West. Who will be more successful in this game? God knows. So far, it seems to me, Chinese were much more efficient in their diplomacy.
Well, Dr. Shevstova, unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there's time for just one last question. In January of 2009, the United States will have a new administration. If that administration is Democratic rather than Republican, how might that affect U.S.-Russian relations?
I don't think that, well, just making this analysis of the past, I don't think that any change of administration in Washington may have a radical or crucial impact on the U.S.-Russian relations. Maybe in nuances, but I don't think that radically. A lot depends, first of all, on Russia's position, on the Russian foreign policy, on what Russia would put on the table. But as for Democratic administration, at least my hope and my belief maybe would be that this administration will not take Russia for granted, because this is unnecessary luxury to ignore the country, which is so big, so unpredictable, and so dangerous. Thank you.
Thank you. Our thanks to Dr. Lilia Shevstova, Senior Associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and author of Russia Lost in Transition, The Yeltsin and Putin Legacies. Thank you for your comments, Dr. Shevstova. And we thank our audiences here and on the radio. This program has been part of the Commonwealth Club's Russia series, sponsored by Pitch and Kathy Johnson. I'm Joe Epstein, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.